John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, December 3, 2012. A Palestinian man killed by Israeli soldiers' gunfire in the West Bank, and Israeli attacks against Gaza fishermen escalates. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian man was killed on Monday by Israeli troops' gunfire at a checkpoint near the northern West Bank city of Tul Karim. Eyewitnesses told local news that soldiers refused to allow ambulance crews from reaching the man when he was shot. Local sources identified the man as Hatim Shadid, 38, from the village of Allar near Tul Karim. According to witnesses, soldiers chased Shadid and rammed his car off-road, then opened fire at him, killing him. Israeli sources said that soldiers suspected the man of having a shuffle in his car. In other news, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, PCHR, announced that Israeli attacks against fishermen in Gaza escalated despite the Israeli authorities' announcement of allowing the fishermen to fish up to 6 nautical miles off the Gaza shore in the context of the ceasefire mediated by Egypt last month. Since the ceasefire agreement came about, PCHR says Israeli occupation forces have arrested 29 fishermen, including 14 who were arrested over the weekend. Additionally, 9 fishing boats were confiscated and damaged, including 3 boats that were confiscated over the weekend. Elsewhere, the Israeli security services expressed rejection of the new Israeli government decision to build additional 3,000 units for Jewish settlers in occupied East Jerusalem and the West Bank, and said that the move is uncalculated. Israeli news sources reported that the new decision, that was also described as angry move by Israeli security officials, who also described the decision as hasty, as there is no need to punish the Palestinians for granting UN General Assembly overwhelming approval vote as a non-member state as long as the Palestinians refrain from suing Israel at the International Criminal Court. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, December 3rd news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hossam Kassis and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
Eight days of violence that began with Israeli airstrikes targeting Gaza militants who fired rockets into Israel, which led to an escalation of some 1,500 cross-border airstrikes and rocket attacks on both sides, claimed the lives of an estimated 169 Palestinians in Gaza and six Israelis, with hundreds more injured. A ceasefire brokered by Egyptian officials went into effect on November 21st. In the second phase of the ceasefire agreement, negotiations began in Cairo on November 25th to discuss establishing new border regulations in Gaza. Hamas, the Palestinian Islamist party that governs Gaza, is demanding that Israel lift its economic blockade imposed in 2007 that restricts the movement of goods, construction material, and people in and out of the Gaza Strip. Israel, for its part, says it wants an end to the smuggling of arms into Gaza and the production of weapons inside the territory. Cindy and Craig Corey are the parents of Rachel Corey, a 23-year-old American peace activist from Olympia, Washington, who was crushed to death by an Israeli bulldozer on March 16, 2003, while undertaking nonviolent direct action to protect the home of a Palestinian family from demolition. An Israeli civil court ruled on August 24th that the Israeli army was not at fault for Rachel's death. Your reporter spoke with Cindy and Craig Corey, who were part of an interfaith peacebuilders delegation from the U.S. that visited Gaza from November 5th through the 11th. They talk about their views on the recent Israeli assault and current ceasefire, as well as the obstacles standing in the way of achieving a lasting and just Middle East peace.
The violence started actually while we were there, and in fact is going on all the time, because Gaza is under siege, as I think most of your listeners know, and in fact under occupation, while the Israeli settlers left several years ago, and so maybe it's not under colonization. Even while we were there, there were bulldozers and tanks inside Gaza, and they were bulldozing down olive trees so that somebody's crop that maybe not just they planted, but maybe their grandfather or maybe their grandfather's grandfather planted that crop, and it gets bulldozed down. The day we went in, which was November 5th, a disabled person was shot and killed, a Palestinian, as he walked too close to the border there. And on Friday, I guess 4 days after we went in, we actually were in a tent where there was a funeral going on for a boy. A 13-year-old boy was killed by the Israelis. He was shot. The Israeli, I guess through their spokespeople, say that they saw somebody doing something suspicious. But we talked to the 13-year-old boy's friends. He was playing goalie. He was a goalkeeper on their team. He was playing outside his front door of his house in the street, and he was shot. He collapsed on the steps trying to get home. His brother took him to the hospital, and he was declared dead just a little while later. So even after that, there was attempts to get a ceasefire. But my understanding is that was broken when Israelis bombed a funeral procession. I don't think it was a funeral for this child. But anyway, and then, of course, the rockets did start wholesale back and forth. And so I think it's with a lot of horror. I'm a Vietnam vet. I've been under rocket fire. I know that's hard. We certainly have friends and children that we know on the Israeli side of that green line. But those rockets aren't like the bombs that woke us up in the middle of the night, our last night, Saturday night there. There were already some bombs starting to drop, and, you know, the flash and the concussion of that is a different animal. So it's with horror that we look at that, and I think we call on leaders on all sides to have the courage to reach out for ceasing the violence and calling for peace, not for justification for more violence.
From your point of view, Cindy, what do Americans not know about Gaza that they should, to provide some context for this the ongoing tension and violence there?
Well, it's a very small place, you know, roughly 30 miles long, 5 to 12 miles wide in different areas. There are 1.7 million people living there. I think it's important for people to realize the restrictions that have been placed on Palestinians just to secure their livelihoods. Unemployment has been running right at 30%. It was higher at times. I think over close to 40% are living under the poverty level, which is $2 a day, and that would be even higher if it weren't for all of the aid that has gone in. We're familiar with the buffer zone area for farmers. Craig talked about the boy who was killed. And those bulldozers and tanks that were coming in, that was on Palestinian land. The Israelis have tried to take a buffer zone, or have taken a buffer zone area of 300 meters, sometimes up to over a kilometer. And again, it's such a small place that to take this much area throughout the Gaza Strip is taking so much of the farmland. So there's a lot to say about Gaza, but I hope at least in the current context that people will consider some of these things.
Craig, I'd like to ask you, having been on the ground there several times in the region and observing the horrible violence that continues to engulf the people there regularly, what are some of the things that you would like the United States, the Obama administration, to concentrate on to try and resolve this seemingly implacable a conflict that goes on decade to decade?
Well, I think that for one thing, we need, and our government could help do this, we need to educate ourselves fairly about what's going on there. I would actually like to see our government just every day list to the press what's gone on there and use entirely neutral language. So, you know, if a rocket's fired, that's horrific. You know, when a rocket's fired, we ask Israel to respond with restraint. Then when a artillery is fired from Israel, we ought to note that and ask Hamas to respond with restraint. You know, for instance, that phrase, respond with restraint, is code words, I think, to say, go get them, guys. So what I'm saying is, I think that one thing, our government needs to respond to this thing with equal language. Neither side is supposed to be violently attacking the civilians of the other side. Israel has an active duty to protect the people that's under occupation, and the United States recognizes that this is an occupation. So I think they could do that. We talked to high-level White House officials over 2 years ago when the attack on the Mamie Marmara happened, and that person told us that it became obvious that the closure of Gaza was a failed policy. And when he said that, he said, I don't mean that we should put more food in there. I mean that they ought to be able to export as well as import. Their students ought to be able to go away to college. Business people ought to be able to come in and out. They ought to have continuing electricity and not have only 8 hours of electricity a day for them. He went down this whole long list, and when he was done, Cindy turned to him and said, that's our list. That's why we came. They should put that, you know, knowing that that policy is a failure, they ought to take some real active steps to turn that about.
That was Cindy and Craig Corey, the parents of Rachel Corey. Learn more about Interfaith Peace Builders and the Rachel Corey Foundation for Peace and Justice by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Afghanistan, 2nd of December. So-called coalition forces report that a soldier of unreported nationality was killed in action in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, 2nd of December. 9 suicide attackers launched a coordinated attack on Jalalabad Air Base, known as an occupation base since the Soviet War. The battle began with a heavy car bomb explosion at the gate, followed by a 2-hour firefight. Some reports state that 3 separate bombs were detonated at the entrance to the base. It took helicopter gunships to stop some of the attackers. While the battle was ongoing, Al Jazeera reported that attackers had succeeded in entering the base. Lieutenant Colonel Hagen Messer, a spokesman for so-called coalition forces, denies Al Jazeera's report that the base perimeter was breached. At least 5 Afghan government soldiers or civilian employees were killed. Nobody is talking about how many foreign troops at this U.S.-dominated base were wounded. Afghanistan, 3rd of December. A remote-controlled motorcycle bomb aimed at an Afghan Army patrol truck killed 2 Afghan Army soldiers and 3 civilians. 8 people, including 2 soldiers, were wounded by the bomb. Pakistan, 3rd of December. A police van was bombed, killing 2 officers and wounding 2 others on the outskirts of Peshawar. Afghanistan, 1st of December. A U.S. or NATO drone was destroyed by NATO troops after crashing due to a reported mechanical failure. No report on whether or not the mechanical failure was the kind that happens when an aircraft is hit by gunfire. Pakistan, 1st of December. At least 4 people were killed and 3 others injured as U.S. drones fired 2 missiles at a house in Pakistan's northwest tribal area of South Waziristan. Mr. Barack Obama, nobody has ever conquered Afghanistan. Not Alexander the Great, not Britain, not the Soviet Union, and you can't do it either. All you are doing is killing people and making enemies. Now is the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops and all of the drones home today. This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTradio@hushmail.com. On the 3rd of December, the over 2-month-long blockade of construction of the southern leg of the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline escalated to a new level. 2 activists locked themselves directly inside a section of the partially built Keystone XL Phase 3, once again halting construction. Here are the timeline updates as posted on www.tarsandsblockade.org. That's www.tarsandsblockade.org. Update, 7:30 a.m. Workers arrive. Construction is effectively halted. Update, 8:45 a.m. Sheriffs arrive on site and are consulting with workers and talking into the pipe. Update, 9 a.m. Police warn blockaders to leave the pipe or face arrest. The blockaders refuse to comply. Update, 9:20 a.m. Police threaten to use tear gas on peaceful protesters. Several sheriffs are shining flashlights into the pipe and threatening to use tear gas on the people inside. The blockaders are standing strong and remain barricaded inside the pipe. Holding fast to their principles, Men in Glatt respond, quote, "We will not be deterred by threats of violence." The blockaders were shown wearing respirators and goggles in a photograph for protection against poisonous tar sands oil or tear gas. Update, 9:50 a.m. Officers are threatening to send a police dog into the pipe. Police are saying they will send a canine unit into the pipe after the protesters. There are no dogs on scene, but police claim they are having them brought to the scene. Update, 10:40 a.m. Police threaten to lift pipe and dump out Glenn and Matt. Police are continuing to threaten tear gas and canine units. They are also saying they could raise the pipe and dump onto blockaders. Doing so would cause serious harm or even death. Matt and Glenn are locked between 2 barrels of concrete which weigh over 600 pounds each. Update, 10:55 a.m. Crowd gathers to support blockaders inside Keystone XL pipeline. People driving by the scene are showing their support by honking and stopping to talk to protesters about the dangers of toxic tar sands. Despite threats of violence, spirits are high. The crowd and Glenn and Matt are singing together. Update, 11:20 a.m. Police attempting to block view of pipe and move supporters further from scene. Police have moved several trucks and vans to obstruct the view of the pipe in which Glenn and Matt are locked. They have threatened arrest and forced supporters off the property immediately adjacent to the pipeline easement, despite the fact that the homeowner gave protesters explicit permission to be in her yard. Police are also forcing protesters to move further along the public road along which they were standing. Update, 12:05 p.m. 2 police officers enter the pipe, emerge a few minutes later. Glenn and Matt are still locked inside the pipe. The police have been completely unable to extract him, but continue to threaten various extraction techniques which would endanger the blockaders' lives, such as cutting into the pipe. Breaking. Blockaders forcibly extracted from pipe. Police brought an ambulance to the scene and then began pulling on one of the barrels. The crowd surged onto the easement to protect Glenn and Matt from this dangerous extraction, but were driven away by the police. Both barrels and the 2 blockaders have been removed from the pipe. TransCanada, that's one workday lost due to the primary efforts of just 2 people. The main Tree-Sit blockade has been blocking you in another location for 71 days as this is recorded. The people who care about our Earth on Turtle Island will not let you build this pipeline nor use it, no matter what it takes to stop you and no matter what the price. The Lakota compare it to the railroad that brought them genocide, and a prominent scientist said it's game over for the climate if the Alberta tar sands are ever burned. We're not fooling around on this. One way or another, the Keystone XL will be stopped, and that gusher of filthy tar sands oil will be shut in. On the 1st of December, Earthquaker Action Team carried out a national day of action against PNC Bank, either the number one or number two investor in mountaintop removal coal mining. 15 branches of PNC Bank were hit by protests, including the one here in D.C. at DuPont Circle, which was closed for 2 hours because of a nonviolent protest by Quakers and Climate First. When an advance team of four, two with PNC accounts and checkbooks, approached the bank, they intended to enter and demand to speak with the branch manager. They found all doors of the bank locked 5 hours before their normal Saturday closing time.
They're already scared. I was on the wall away and they're scared.
Doors locked.
Have you got your checkbook or something?
Their account holder.
No account holder was let in during that 2 hours. Not even an unrelated customer who ended up banging on the window demanding to be let in. This was because of PNC Bank's investments in mountaintop removal coal mining.
And I am here today to work for Appalachia. I can't live in Appalachia because I live around here. But I can still try to help Appalachia people and get rid of mountaintop removal mining. It's an absolute disgrace to be polluting our water. The stuff that comes out of the ground in Appalachia, the coal, we burn it here. I see it every week going by on the freight train when I'm going to work. The freight train goes by with Appalachian coal in it, and we burn it here. So we are in part responsible for polluting groundwater in Appalachia.
PNC Bank, this is just the beginning. Many groups are mobilizing to shut down mountaintop removal coal mining, and Patriot Coal has just thrown in the towel and shut down their big mountaintop removal mine. Your investments in this form of coal mining are going to lose more and more value, and other groups might come to the homes of your executives to protest. Now is the time to do the right thing and dump mountaintop removal investments before they dump any more poison into water. And if you're listening to this and you have an account in PNC Bank, you just might want to move your money and dump your ties to mountaintop removal.
On November 15th, the Patriot Coal Corporation announced a settlement agreement with the Sierra Club and two Appalachian advocacy groups to phase out mountaintop removal coal mining and eventually all surface mining. The company issued a statement that continuing that form of mining was in neither the company's nor the surrounding community's best interest, stating that Patriot Coal recognizes that our mining operations impact the communities in which we operate in significant ways. Among the operations to be shut down is the Hobet Mine Complex, the largest mountaintop removal site in Appalachia, which two dozen activists briefly occupied in July in an effort to draw attention to the destruction wrought by mountaintop removal mining. Patriot Coal's announcement was the culmination of years of litigation conducted by the nonprofit public interest law firm Appalachian Mountain Advocates to make mining companies accountable for their destructive environmental practices. In this case, the company was sued under the Clean Water Act because Patriot was releasing more selenium into nearby streams than regulations allow. Selenium, while not harmful to humans, has had a harmful impact on fish and bird species in the region. There will be no immediate layoffs of Patriot's already small workforce because surface mining uses few workers, in contrast to underground mining, which requires more workers to dig and mine the coal. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Joe Lovett, lead attorney with Appalachian Mountain Advocates. He explains how the lawsuit came about and what the victory of the Sierra Club, Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, and the West Virginia Highlands Conservancy in this case could mean for other coal operators.
Well, it's been developing over many years, and it started with the state Department of Environmental Protection's failure to enforce the selenium water quality standard against mining operators. In West Virginia, there's little distinction between the mining industry and the government. And our governors, Governor Manchin and now Governor Tomlin, have done everything they can do to collude with the coal industry to protect it from having to comply with environmental laws. Not only was the DEP, the state environmental agency, refusing to enforce the environmental laws, but it colluded with the industry to prevent citizens from enforcing the laws. So many years ago, we started appealing permits that the DEP was issuing and asking something called the Environmental Quality Board, a regulatory agency, to force the DEP to put limits on. DEP would never put selenium limits on any permit until we finally were successful in suing operators in federal court for failure to comply with state water quality standards for selenium. And really, we won in federal court because the DEP screwed up in its effort to protect the agency, and so it failed to advertise the permits as it was supposed to, and federal court held that that failure to provide proper notice invalidated the permits and that we could sue the mining operators in federal court. And we did, and we sued Patriot, and over many years we sued Patriot for many violations of state water quality standards resulting from selenium, to the point now where Patriot has several hundred million dollars in liability associated with its cleanup of selenium. So in federal consent decrees and federal court orders, Patriot has been assessed hundreds of millions of dollars in cleanup fees, and it has to accomplish all that within the next 5 years or so.
So, Joe Lovett, is that what Patriot meant when it issued a statement that it wasn't in the long-term interest of the company or the surrounding communities to continue surface mining?
Hardly. What really is going on is Patriot now has filed for bankruptcy, but it's not going to liquidate. It's going to reorganize, and it's going to emerge with new financing from some of the largest banks in the country. Patriot should come out of the bankruptcy and continue mining, but it doesn't have the money to do two things. One is it doesn't have the money to pay all of its obligation to miners for their health and retirement benefits. The other is that it doesn't have the money to clean up the environmental liabilities as quickly as it's obligated to under our cases. So we agreed to give Patriot another 10 months to a year to comply with its selenium obligations if it would agree to stop mountaintop removal permanently and to abandon surface mining altogether within the foreseeable future. And Patriot has agreed to that. There's pending before a federal court right now a consent decree that would bind Patriot forever to immediately stop seeking permits for mountaintop removal operations, to close down its current operations in short order, to bring its total surface production to 3 million tons by 2018, and after that to phase out surface production altogether.
So when you say surface mining, are you including mountaintop removal, or MTR, as well as other surface mining?
Yes, all surface mining, what they call small-scale surface mining as well. So MTR is gone very quickly. The other small-scale surface mining is phased out over a number of years. But once current leases expire, there will be no more surface mining for Patriot.
You said Patriot's MTR mining will be over soon. Is there a specific date?
Well, they've given up all of their permit applications except for one, and they've agreed to close down their other operations as they wind down. I would say 2 or 3 years, those will all be wound down, and they won't be seeking any new permits in the meantime.
So if all the other coal companies are in violation of their permits regarding selenium discharge as well, do you think this is the beginning of a domino effect?
I hope so. I think it's going to take longer for the other operators to go. Patriot's particularly vulnerable because it has the most selenium violations and because it's the most financially vulnerable of the companies right now. I do believe that all these companies will become unsound financially if the price of coal drops, and that will make their environmental liabilities much more important as a percentage of their operating costs and will hasten the end of this kind of mining. Unfortunately, it's not going to happen tomorrow, and it's not even going to happen in the next 5 years. And so there's much work to be done to make sure that we protect this region as the companies go out the door. But the companies are leaving, and it should be the obligation of our political leaders to make sure that they pay the cost of their business as they're going.
That was Joe Lovett, lead attorney with the Appalachian Mountain Advocates Law Firm. Learn more about the campaign to end mountaintop removal coal mining by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Children in rags, welfare reform, let them eat cake. Why should we care? Bye, 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 bye. See the greed of the shop and malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line, fat in your belly too. See the greed of the shop and malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line, fat in your belly too. Bye, 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 bye. Rich pigs for his children and rags, welfare reform, let them eat cake. Why should we care? Bye, 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 bye. See the greed of the shop and malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line, fat in your belly too.
On the 26th of November, Mayor Gray's Chief of Staff Chris Murphy sent an insulting email to residents of the CCNV shelter organized under a group called SHARC around homeless advocacy. Mayor Gray, like Jack Evans, has been blowing off all efforts by homeless advocates to arrange a meeting to discuss shelter funding for the year and other issues affecting the poor. Infuriated CCNV residents responded by marching on City Hall.
So here's the deal. The mayor's chief of staff, a guy named Chris Murphy, he emailed me on November 16th. I had never heard of the guy before that day. I didn't know he existed. And he said to me in the email that I think you have the wrong information about the mayor's priorities in terms of schools and charter schools and parks and so forth. And he said, and if you want to come down and have a civil meeting with us, you know, or with me, you know, I'm willing to meet with you. And he entitled his email an offer. Okay, so I took him up on that offer and I said, we don't just shout and shoot. We aren't just rebels without a cause. And we'll go down and talk to you. And then I found this blog post that explains all his policies and how they hurt the poor. I emailed that around, and so anyway, you know, I said, well, maybe this is what he's referring to, you know, and he got insulted, and he said that I was disrespectful to him. So he and I had a real sharp exchange this morning via email, and he actually called off the, or he didn't call it off, but he said he might call off the meeting he's going to have with SHARC on Wednesday in 2 days. You know, and so anyway, we're going to make a video real fast and put it out to him and let him know that we're galvanizing and that if he is unprofessional like that, it's going to look real bad for him because a public official should not get that easily insulted. I didn't call him any names. I was real nice. I didn't curse him out. I was absolutely nice in the email and he got insulted anyway.
In response to this outrageous insult, CCNV shelter residents in SHARC vowed to bum rush City Hall in a chant during the march to City Hall.
Say what? Bum rush City Hall! We're gonna bum rush City Hall!
Say what?
Bum rush City Hall! We're gonna bum rush City Hall!
Say what?
All right. I'm glad everybody came out, and I want to tell y'all that Councilman Jim Graham, who has oversight of human services, has said multiple times, you know, I see the same five advocates down here all the time. What if we have 7,000 homeless, why aren't more of them here?
Thank you!
So, now, here we are in larger numbers, and we're going to get even larger next month, okay? We're going to keep on growing, but for now, let's try to
be peaceful, okay? Even though they pissed me off this morning, the mayor's office, we're still going to be nice today.
We got babies.
I'm going to be nice.
So
let's give them a chance to cooperate with us. Let's tell them our demands. Speak from your heart. What we want. You want affordable housing. You want living wage jobs. Let them know, okay? And if they don't make good, next time, we're going to come back and rap. But this time around, let's be nice about it, okay?
All right.
And that's me saying that, and I'm known to be nasty. Okay? So let's go on it.
Activists from SHARC then joined forces with activists from RDC and marched into the district building. SHARC stands for Shelter, Housing, Respect, and Change. Unfortunately, the mayor's scheduling department was all full of excuses again, this time claiming to have lost the previous application to meet with the mayor and saying it'd be 3 months to schedule another meeting with the mayor.
Hi, I'm Carla Bouchard. We're trying to schedule a meeting with the mayor. We've been trying to schedule it for months. We filed the proper paperwork November 1st. Here we are at the end of the month. They ping-pong from office to office. And we can't even make an appointment to see the scheduler to schedule a meeting with the mayor. So this is the most inaccessible public office I've ever encountered in my life.
Here's the excuses and delaying tactics that SHARC got in return. Excuses and delays that surely would not be faced by a developer bringing boatloads of money for the mayor's next re-election campaign.
It goes to first it goes to con respondents twice, two people, then it goes to the scheduler. Yeah. So it's going to be about 3 months before you get a meeting.
That's what I call inaccessible. Of course, if SHARC had been there to talk about the wonderful new condominiums they wanted to build for people making between $200,000 and $300,000 a year, you can bet the mayor's office would have been a lot more accessible than this. Of course, SHARC is all about housing for the homeless and the poor, not for rich single professionals. A 3 month delay at the beginning of winter. Could it be that Mayor Gray is hoping that homeless people will freeze to death prior to that meeting?
When we came in earlier, there were probably about 60 of us, and we went to Councilman Jim Grant's office, had a friendly meeting, and then later on we came up here to the mayor's executive office, and we've been trying since November 1st to get a meeting with the mayor. I filled out an application and went through the proper process, and here it is, the 26th, 3.5 weeks later, we still don't have a confirmed date. The process to me has been very unprofessional. They kind of leave you hanging. And then when you come in the office here, you don't get any straight answers a lot of times. And I had to really prod and pry to get any semblance of a straight answer from the people that we just spoke to. And so we still don't know when we're going to meet with the mayor. We've been told that it could be a 3 month wait to meet with him. Almost 1 month has passed already. They say that it might be January or February when that meeting happens, and that they're just now scheduling people for the end of December. And so our meeting may take place next year. The mayor had emergency legislation to give funding to schools for upgrades. And yet, homelessness, you know, which is a real emergency, especially in the winter, it takes us 2 or 3 months to get a meeting with the mayor. And so I'm very dissatisfied with the process for getting a meeting with the mayor and the process for them gathering public complaints and corresponding with the mayor concerning what the public has to say. I find this to be very unsatisfactory. I will put it out there. I will blog about it. When I filled out the paper asking for a meeting with the mayor, it somehow got lost. And when I went to Facebook 12 days later and I put it on Facebook, I got a call and an email immediately, and they want to protect the mayor's image, but they don't want to make sure that what he does is effective and that he's accessible. This mayor is actually less accessible than the previous mayor, you know, and so I'm very dissatisfied with that, and hopefully things will get better. But I do feel like we put a lot of pressure on people in this office. I think they felt us. I think they're going to convey that pressure and that tension to the mayor. Let's hope that happens, okay? Because I'm not trying to be nice anymore. And I hope nobody here with me is trying to be nice either. You know, in the words of Chuck, no more Mr. Nice Guy.
I heard that. It's obvious that being nice doesn't work with somebody like Mayor Gray. The message of Shark to Mayor Gray is simple. We can do this the easy way, or we can do this the hard way.